everybody. There's no gavel up here, but I want to welcome everybody here to the second installation of our House Resources Lunch and Learn Committee meeting. This is a thing we do every week, an effort to have more informal communication and interaction between legislators, resource industry experts, and staff, and passersby. It's highly educational, and it's kind of informal, so glad you're here. Our session today is entitled, Who is the Alaska Coal Association? And will be presented by Lorelei Simon, who is the Vice President of External Affairs with Yuzhno-Beli Coal Mine. And I guess Dan Graham, who is an engineer and president of the Alaska Coal Association, will be driving the PowerPoint. But here to tell you a little bit more about our presenters is Representative Feige, my co-chair.
Thank you, co-chair. I get the feeling that we're probably in the first episode of that new Alaska reality series that's probably coming out here shortly called Alaska Coal Wars. But if that becomes the case and it does turn into a war, Lorelei Simon is certainly qualified to lead the charge. She comes from a family that was one of the original colonist families here in the Matsu Valley. Grew up in Palmer, graduated from Palmer High School, went on to earn a bachelor's degree in political science. I'm not sure how useful that really is, but and a master's degree in public administration is probably a little bit more useful from the University of Alaska at Anchorage. She serves as a trustee of the University of Alaska Foundation, a board member for Access Alaska, the Greater Palmer Chamber of Commerce, and the RDC, the Resource Development Council. She is currently the secretary treasurer for the Alaska Coal Association. Please welcome Lorelei Simon. And just to be fair, recognizing Representative Nagiak, Representative Tammy Wilson, and Representative Doug Isaacson, who seem to be well into their meal.
Thank you.
All yours, Laura.
Thank you. Yes, nice to meet you all. I'm Lorelei Simon, as the representatives introduced, but I do have to say that my claim to fame is that I'm a former legislative aide, but even before that, I was a legislative intern. So, see, even you too can go somewhere if you've been a legislative intern. But I would like Dan Graham to also please introduce himself. He's a colleague of mine in the coal industry.
Oh. Thanks, Lori. I'm just here to help Lorelei out. I'm Dan Graham. I've been involved, graduated from mining engineering up in Fairbanks in 1988. I lived in Alaska. This will be my 30th year up here and worked in the coal industry almost that entire time. So. Here for technical support, but don't have near the qualifications of Lorelei for speaking, so we'll let her lead the charge here.
Actually, Dan and I are going to kind of tag team the presentation today. Again, being an engineer, he can get into a lot of the nitty-gritty a lot easier than I can, so we'll go ahead and get started. We really appreciate the opportunity to come and give you all a kind of overview of the coal industry in Alaska, pretty much the state of the state's coal industry. You can see that Alaska is really rich in coal resources. We actually have about half of the nation's coal resources right here in the state of Alaska, and 20% of the world's coal resources. The reserves are really distributed pretty well throughout the state, from south central Alaska up through the interior, along a lot of the major river systems, and throughout the North Slope. We also have coal deposits in Prince William Sound, along the Aleutians, and near Kodiak Island in southeast Alaska. However, despite its abundance, Alaska's only operating coal mine is in Healy, and that's Yuzhno-Beli Coal Mine, which is who I work for. It's the only producing coal mine in the state. There are two additional mines that are in the advanced permitting and pre-development stages, and new exploration and activity is underway in at least three other properties. It's probably difficult to see the slide just because it's on a white background and there's a lot of light, but we will go through each of these projects and give you guys a basic understanding of where they're at. We do like to talk about... thanks, Dan. We like to talk about the... Cook away. Thank you. Since I work for Yuzhno-Beli Coal Mine, I'll talk about our company's projects and then we'll move into Pacrim, where Dan will talk over and talk about his project. As I said before, we're the only operating coal company in the state. Yucca Valley was founded in 1943. We're celebrating our 70th anniversary this year, something we're very proud of. Our company started out producing about 10,000 tons a year, which might seem like a lot, but we can actually produce that in about a day now, just with the increases in technology. In 2011, we hit a record where we produced over 2 million tons out of our mine in Healy. About half of that stays in state, and we fire 6 coal-burning power plants in Alaska, and the other 1 million tons goes out on the export market, and we have clients in Chile, South Korea, and Japan. This is a photograph, a little bit of a map of our property in Healy. Sorry, Representative Seller, I'm just kind of standing in your way here.
You're my family.
Okay. We have about 700 million tons of known reserves in the Healy area. So I like to use the example of there are thousands of years of coal mining available in the interior just in that Healy area, or generations of coal miners coming after us. If you took all of those, if you look at the energy demand today in Alaska, we could use, just using coal, we could produce about 1,000 years of electricity. Again, assuming that our demand doesn't go up, but just what we use today. As I said, mining started in 1943. We jumped over to the Hosiana Valley in the early 1970s, opened Poker Flats in the mid-70s, and we acquired a drag line in the 80s. And this was one of the big steps for our company, and I have a photograph I'll show you of a drag line. But as I talk about the increase in production and the use of new technology, the drag line was a big step for our country, or for our company. And one thing I like to point out is our mine in Healy shares a border with Denali National Park. So our operating coal mine is close to one of the biggest tourist attractions in the country. So when we talk about coexistence of user groups like tourism and industry, our mine in Healy certainly it gives an excellent example. This is a photograph of our drag line. Dan, you can use your little laser pointer there, point to the bucket. The bucket up here, we use this piece of equipment to move dirt. This isn't something that we actually use to mine coal. We use this piece of machinery to move the dirt so we can get to the coal seam. That bucket is about the size of 3 dump trucks. So you can get the idea of how much dirt we can move by using this drag line. And if you point to that little pickup truck down there on the bottom, that is a 1-ton pickup. So that should give you a good idea of really how big the drag line is. I want to say that it's still the largest piece of mobile equipment in the state. We use this to obviously move around the mine, depending on which active pit we're in. We'll get to some reclamation slides as well, but part of the mining sequence at Yucca Valley is to use something called contemporaneous reclamation. So we backfill as we move through the mining sequence. It helps lessen the open footprint and helps reclamation begin earlier. Thanks, Dan. This is a photograph of reclamation. I'll move out of the way so you guys can see this a little bit. You can see on the left in 2003, that was the Poker Flats mine area. We had just begun reclamation then. All those little yellow flowers are an excellent, they provide an excellent vegetative match so that when we go in there and plant the trees, there's already a great root system. So here you go 9 years later on the right, and that's in 2012. This is something that Yucca Valley Coal Mine is very proud of, and certainly the coal mining industry as a whole. But our company is very proud of our reclamation efforts because we started reclaiming old mine lands even before it was required by the federal government. And the primary reason is because the Yucca Valleys live in Healy, right? This is their front yard, their backyard. They recognize the value of being good stewards of the environment and taking care of the land. I like to use this picture and say, I challenge you to tell me that there was ever an active coal mine here. You saw on the slide previously where the drag line was operating. Okay, it's not pretty, right? It kind of just looks like a big hole in the ground with a bunch of dirt, right? But yet we can restore it to this standard, and that's something that we're very proud of. Thanks, Dan. Pre-development projects, Yucca Valley also has the Wishbone Hill project. You may have heard about this. It's located about 10 miles north of Palmer in the Sutton area. The Wishbone Hill project actually comes, it's located in the Matanuska coal fields, and so it's a traditional mining area. Mining began back there in the early 1900s, and particularly for Wishbone Hill, exploration began in the early 80s. And by the early 90s, about 1992, the mine was actually completely permitted. For one reason or another, the planets have never aligned and the project has never been fully developed. My friend Jeff Jesse is here from the Mental Health Trust Authority, and we never miss the opportunity to talk about the relationship between resource development and mental health trust lands. And the reason this project didn't move forward in the 90s is because the state sued itself. And if you haven't had the opportunity to listen to Mr. Jesse's presentation on mental health trust lands, I would certainly encourage you to do it. But basically, development of mental health trust lands in the state of Alaska goes to help fund mental health programs in the state. So there are mental health lands here in the Wishbone Hill area. The Wishbone Hill mine is really a relatively small deposit. As I said, we have about 700 million tons of known reserves in Healy. Wishbone Hill is a lot smaller. We have a feasibility study that's based on the most economically mineable 6 million tons. So you can see it's a much smaller deposit. This is just a photograph from mine area 2 there in the area. Go ahead, thanks, Dan. And I'll turn it over to Dan so we can talk about Pacrim.
Thanks, Lorelei. Yeah, this is a project we know a little bit about, similar to, in fact, very similar to the Wishbone Hill project. The Pacrim deposit dates back to the 60s with initial exploration leases issued in 1972, and it went through a permitting phase in the 80s as well. Permits were issued in the late 80s and early 1990s. It was challenged and upheld in court, but similar to Wishbone, when everything was ready to go, the mental health trust litigation was in place. Lands in this area were also involved in that. So until those cleared, which I believe was 1994, 95, in that time period, the coal markets had a steep decline, and both the Wishbone and the Chuitna project were not developed at that point in time. Our owners, the same owners as then, saw an opportunity coming in the coal export market beginning in 2005, and we reinitiated the effort to obtain permits on the project. The first applications were submitted in 2006. We're still in that process, and we anticipate a year to two more of permitting to go, so we're hoping by 2014, which will be 8 years from the first application, we'll have some permit decisions and know if we can develop the project or not. What our project is it's unique in the fact that it's a sizable deposit. It's 300 million tons in this proposed mine area. At 12 million tons a year, that'll last us 25 years. Because there's no other coal development in the area, we'll have to build an overland transport system to get the coal from the mine area to a point of sale. We're very fortunate in the fact that we're tidewater. That's what makes this deposit extremely unique, is we don't have that overland transportation component that so many deposits have, which gives us a competitive advantage in those respects. And then we'd have to build a port, which is the downside. Not many mines have to build their own port facility, but this project would have to develop its own port here for loading ships in Cook Inlet. There's not a lot of population over here. There's the native village of Tionic, and then there's a community of Beluga up here. There's the Beluga power plant, Chugach Electrics. So the workforce is limited. We have committed to working with the folks at Tionic to employ as many as are available. But the size of our workforce will be 350 jobs during operation, so we'll have to look elsewhere. So it also includes a camp set up for housing workers over there. And then a couple more things, and this is what's unique about this update, is for so many years when you talked about coal, you talked about Yucca Valley and maybe one or two other things. So we've just covered three projects there. There's also a couple other projects ongoing in the state, which which we find exciting, and that's why we felt it was a time. You don't hear much about coal, so it's a good time to tell people that it's not just one or two operations. There's a company, they're out of Australia, Riversdale, that acquired leases again for the Mental Health Trust, and the Chuitna Project also would pay royalties to the Mental Health Trust. They're under exploration right now. They're looking for a much higher grade coal. Lorelei's company and our company were steam coal, or electric generation is what we're after. This project is moving up into the anthracite grade of coal, which is made for making steel. It's a lot higher value product. They don't know if they have a deposit there or not, but they're in the exploration phase. They've got just under 10,000 acres under lease. They did their initial drilling last year. This was some of their work. And one thing I would like to credit Riversdale with is I think they did an excellent job in working with local contractors, local community. They hired Alaska Sciences out of Anchorage to manage their program. There's a small company called Ukuskokon that supplied the geologists to the program. There's Joe Winiger and his family have built a drill. They live down KGB Road. Riversdale hired him to come in and do some of the drilling work for that. They used local contractors for getting all their access and moving their equipment in and around. And they also used local B&Bs and a lodge there for their housing of crews. So I think Riversdale did a great job. This was some of the geologists they had on the project site there. And that's some of the core that they pulled. Their findings were encouraging enough where they do plan on coming back for some additional field work next year. So this is a stay tuned. It's still in the exploration phase. I don't know if they have a mineable deposit, but that's a project of interest. There's also another project sandwiched right between the Riversdale project, which is up by Chickalone, and Busabelli's Wishbone project just out of Sutton, and it's the Jonesville project. A company called Black Range Minerals owns that. It actually has a permit in place for mining, but there is no active mining. I think the last mining there took place in 1967. But they, in addition to the mine permit, they put in an application for some additional exploration work to further define their deposit and refine their mine plans. So they're in the process. And then another development that's come up recently is the state of Alaska is proposing to issue some new coal leases out on the west side of the Susitna River. A company called Alaska Energy Corporation approached the state, knew of this area, and has expressed an interest in obtaining leases in that area. DGGS looked at the available information, and they predict there could be as much as 200 million tons of coal in that deposit. So here's Anchorage. This is where the Chuitna project is. This is where Wishbone, Jonesville, and then the Riversdale project is up in here, and then these new leases are actually over on the west flank. So it's all part of the same Cook Inlet Basin, but they're further up, closer to the Skwentna River there. So the public hearing process closed. The state will be deciding if they're going to issue these leases, and so this is another one just to stay tuned for. We'll see. But I think it's an encouraging development in the Mat-Su borough. There are a couple other deposits have been around. The Arctic Slope, you might have heard of the Dead False Incline. What on this map, if you can see it, these green colors are the really high-grade coal. And you can see our North Slope is where the bulk of our coal deposits are. This is one that Arctic Slope Regional Corporation owns this area. They've had several exploration programs up in that. BHP was in looking at it here a few years ago. So that's got potential in there. And then there's also some other coal leases down near our project area in the Beluga coal field. There's also some work underway with underground coal gasification. Link Energy's looking at some in the area, as well as Siri, in a partnership with another company looking at that aspect of using coal. So.
With the exception of the Mine Mouth plant in Healy, Alaska, all of the in-state use for coal travels on the Alaska Railroad, as well as our export business. So we use the Alaska Railroad to ship our coal down to Healy, or I'm sorry, down to Seward, where there's an existing coal loading facility there. Thanks, Dan. This is just an excellent slide provided by the Alaska Railroad Corporation that just shows their export coal numbers from 2007 to 2012. You can definitely see the increase here in 2010 to 2012. Our exports in 2013 we expect to be just a little less than 2012, but hopefully we'll pick up another couple of ships and be able to exceed that. Thanks. This is a photograph of the Seward Coal Terminal, and Dan can kind of use a laser pointer and show you where the train comes in, the stacker reclaimer, that's the coal pile there, and then the coal travels out on the conveyor system to this area where it's loaded onto the coal ship. And the next slide gives you a good idea of how large a coal ship is. This hauls about 75,000 tons. I also like to use this picture to show the size of the coal ship versus cruise ships, and also again to highlight how tourism and the coal industry can coexist. We've been loading coal out of Seward for about 30 years, and it's safe to say that the cruise ship industry really did grow up around the coal industry. So in-state use of coal, I kind of already talked about the six coal-burning power plants. Everybody in this room is talking about Alaska's energy needs, right? And how are we going to meet Alaska's energy needs? And there's a big focus on natural gas. I live in South Central Alaska. I certainly appreciate having natural gas. However, the next couple of slides will show you how much coal we use in-state versus other fuel sources, like you can see here. This is in the United States. This slide's a little bit old. It's actually just less than 50% of the United States energy is produced by coal. And then the next graph shows in Alaska how we use primarily natural gas. You can see coal to the far right. It's only about 4%. And this next photograph, or this next slide, shows you electricity rates based on the use of coal. So up here to the left, we see Alaska. So we are among the highest ratepayers in the country, and we are among the least amount of coal. Yet down here in Wyoming, where they use nearly 100% of coal to fuel their energy, their power plants, they are among the lowest ratepayers. Okay, so as we talk about Alaska's energy needs, we would certainly appreciate the conversation to include coal as well. Is there anything else you want to point out on that, Dan?
No, the one thing, and this is this isn't a knock on the utilities, but you know, this is the U.S. mix versus ours, and we're really heavily dependent on gas. Mm-hmm. And if you think of the new generation being added, MLMP and Chugach just put in another 150 megawatts in Anchorage, and it's all fired by gas. And MEA is just in the throes of building another new power plant, another 170 megawatts or so, and it also is looking at gas or possibly diesel fuel if it can't find a gas contract. So while we're already out of whack with the U.S. mix, we've amplified our issues by building more gas-fired power into the grid rather than diversifying the mix.
It seems like whenever you discuss coal as a fuel source for generation, you can't help but also discuss emissions. And I could take another entire hour just discussing technology in generation for coal power plants. However, you can do your own research, and you can see that some of the new coal plants being built today are just as clean as natural gas plants. This is a list of our in-state users for our coal. All of the ones that have a star are cogeneration plants, which means it uses what would be a byproduct, the steam coming out of the tower. It uses that to provide hot water and heat to surrounding areas, like downtown Fairbanks, the University of Alaska. They're on a cogen system. Thanks, Dan. We know that you guys are hearing a lot from the power companies, and so we thought, as the Coal Association, we certainly have to highlight new coal generation coming on our grid, but knowing that you're going to get a lot more detail from people who are intimately involved with this with these projects, certainly the University of Alaska Fairbanks, they're going to build a new coal system there. In addition, the Healy Clean Coal Plant, which really we cannot call it new, right, because this discussion has been around for decades. But finally, you can go ahead and click that. Finally, the Healy Clean Coal Plant should be coming online soon. This is a gorgeous picture on the left-hand side of the Healy Clean Coal Plant in downtown Healy, right? I don't know if you've ever been there, but that's kind of fun. This is downtown Healy. And then on the right, that's just a photograph of the boiler. List of direct coal jobs. At Use Valley Coal Mine, we hire about 130 people today. You can look at the Seward Coal Terminal, the railroad, all of the different state and federal agencies, the power plants, to get an idea that there are just over 400 people in Alaska that are directly employed by the coal industry. The average wage in the mining industry in Alaska in 2012 was $100,000 a year. So I use that as a demonstration that these are good paying family wage jobs. And it's not just the salary that folks are bringing home, but it's also what they're making in retirement and benefits. So again, there's anyone in here who might want to switch jobs. The mining industry has a lot of opportunity in Alaska. Okay, so we're almost wrapping up here, but Dan and I like to talk about the challenges that our industry faces. This is a pretty self-explanatory diagram here. The current federal administration's policies on coal and fossil fuels, you can see where Obama got elected. The blue line represents fossil fuels coal. The red is fossil fuels natural gas. The green is fossil fuels total. Yellow is nuclear electric power. And then the other red.
Orange.
One is probably orange, right?
Yeah.
Is renewable energy total. Oh. So you can someone made a joke earlier about the war on coal. I tell you what, this is not a joke. It absolutely is. There are over 200 new rules coming out of the federal government that make it a lot more difficult and a lot more expensive for our companies to do our jobs. Guys, that's boiled down to you as the ratepayers, right? And then the next slide, along the same theme, talks about the amount of money coming in from out of state on anti-coal campaigns. You can click all the way through this, Dan. This is just one funding source. This is the Alaska Conservation Foundation. No Alaska-based funding sources listed in their top donors list, but you can see that in 2011, there was nearly $1.4 million spent just on anti-coal efforts. Now remember, we have one coal plant operating in the state, right? One. We have about 130 people employed there. However, you learned about the other projects that are in exploration and permitting, so you can see the amount of money coming into our state. It's not difficult to track this money back. It's basically coming from the Sierra Club. It's trickling down to the Alaska Conservation Foundation and then trickling down to some of the smaller groups, Cook Inlet Keeper. I won't waste your time going on to the list, but it's definitely something to think about as you hear these things. And I just want to throw this out as well. If you hear something that sounds really scary or maybe just a little strange, Dan and I would be happy to address that with you. You know, give us a call anytime. We're always happy to answer questions, go into greater detail for anything that you've heard today, or if you have other questions, anything coal related. If we don't know it, we can certainly find the answer for you. So we're happy to take questions. If I don't know what your schedule is, or
we've got room for another half hour, so
okay.
Q&A is great.
Yes,
right.
Yes, sir.
So, first, I'm a supporter of coal. My family's originally coal mining in Kentucky, but coal is under a lot of pressure from the EPA. And on the Coal Power website, which is a pro coal website, we've gone from 50% to 37% of our electricity being produced by coal-fired plants. But on the same website, it says we cannot use
We don't have the existing technology to produce a coal plant today that will meet the new EPA regulations of sequestering and carbon capture. So even though we want to maybe generate more power from coal,
right,
how can we build a plant here? And then secondly, India is the obvious place to import Alaska coal to or export to. What can
I'm sorry?
Do? India?
Oh.
We have 300 million people who don't even have electricity. They're going to build 1,200 power plants this year around the world to produce electricity by coal. How do we get our coal to that market and compete in that market? So a couple of questions there.
Do you want first or second? Go ahead.
On the utilization that that drop, you're right, it is down, and that's part of that decline we saw. We've never seen a decline like that in the recent past. Part of that is the regulations being imposed. Part of it is with the fracking, and if you look at natural gas is down it even went under $2. So some of these utilities that had surplus capacity in one or the other have shifted to gas and scaled back their coal-fired plants. If gas prices come up, if they'll bring some of those others back up, the capacity is still there. As far as the new regulations go and hindering that, HCCP actually just went through a consent decree with EPA, and they've shown that they can meet the air quality standards that EPA is proposing on that plant up there, and that's one of the reasons that's finally looks like it's going to go forward. Other plants will have to. It's not that the technology is impossible, but it's definitely making it more expensive. Carbon capture and storage is kind of not part of the discussion yet, but mercury's been a big one. Mercury capture and the levels that they're looking at pulling out of the airstream, it's minute, but they're working on the technology where they can retrofit plants and do that. Consumers will end up paying for that. But think of the 1970, the Clean Air Act came through. We use three times as much more coal now as we did in 1970, and yet total emissions are less than half of what they were in 1970. So personally, I believe in mankind. If we have a challenge, we can rise to meet it. So even though some of these new standards are onerous, I think that we can get the technology to meet some of those standards. So I wouldn't say coal's going to be put completely out of business, but it definitely raised the bar, makes it more challenging.
And you also talked about other countries increasing their coal use. Certainly, we're always looking for opportunities to expand our export market, but it is hard for us to compete up here in this northern environment. We have a lot more expenses and challenges that other countries like Indonesia don't face. So I think a lot of the coal coming out or going into India is actually coming from Indonesia.
Thank you. I'm Ben now. I come from District 40, encompassing the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic Borough. When I was looking at those slides and you were talking about the coal being transported and everything, they have one thing in common. They all have access to your resource, to the coal. Mm-hmm. And there's rail, there's a port. And so whenever I talk about this, we have resources, we're resource-rich, but access poor.
Yeah.
And so when I saw that, you know, you have all this infrastructure in the areas where you're developing coal, but you look farther up north,
right,
and farther west, you don't see none at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should look at some working with people in those regions to start talking about ports, port access and or road access, so we can get more of that and find more markets in where the, you know, because it's you know, with the new shipping lanes may be happening in the next several years because of global change. Up north anyway, there's ice-free. 94 ships of traffic in Barrow alone last summer. So, you know, we're always talking about our resources, but then we don't talk about the access.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, sir. Certainly the biggest challenges of the coal resources being developed in your neighborhood is certainly access and location.
And it's no, let me see if I can just get this cranked real quick.
I think this shows you exactly what you were talking about. Look where all those projects are.
Right.
And yet the resource is up there. And I can't speak on behalf of Arctic Slope, but I do know from being around that project that there's no doubt that there's a resource up there. Their biggest challenge has always been access.
Yeah. So a couple questions following you up with Benny the guy.
So you mentioned, well, back up, we often think of coal as being something for space heating and you know, coal plants, but you mentioned anthracite for steel production, mm-hmm. and you said on the North Slope it's actually better quality. So if we did what Benny is saying and put a road up there, let's say, is there anyone with the Coal Miners Association or that you know that would actively want to mine up there and perhaps use the resources?
Well, I can speak on behalf of every member of the Coal Association and say that we are a for-profit company, right? And we are always interested in making more money by developing our coal resources. So should that project pencil out? Absolutely.
That's the key.
And think about this. You know, Uinta Valley Coal Mine has been operating in Healy for 70 years, just in Healy. It wasn't until 1997 that our company acquired the leases and permits to the Wishbone Hill project in South Central Alaska. And here we are in 2013, and we're still working to develop that project. So even for our company to move into another region that does have access, it's still a major decision for us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean.
But what different type of coal is that would do other than say space heating and electricity? What is that anthracite or?
At Wishbone, it's bituminous coal. So in Healy, we have sub-bituminous. Wishbone is bituminous coal, but it's still a steam coal. It's still used for electric generation.
And on the North Slope, that's
North,
a good product.
North Slope, but some of the stuff that Arctic Slope Regional has on their property is indeed coking coal.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a perspective, it's about per ton is usually the sales price. Coking coal has been carrying about 3 times the value per ton as a steam coal because of the demand in the steel markets.
So it might pencil out easier.
And the other thing with coal is it's a bulk commodity, so that's why transportation links are so key. You can't consolidate it and ship it. You know, you need the volume because that's the users are looking for large volumes of the product. So that's why you need that transportation network. Another problem with the North Slope has been limited shipping windows. You only have 100 days, kind of like what Red Dog does. They have to stockpile and then ship on that 100 days. They have a real high-value concentrate they can get out. With coal, you know, it's harder to do a value-added product with it. Although it's not impossible. There is some coal to liquids and other stuff you can do with coal.
I got a question about, can you speak more about the military's commitment to using coal as a fuel source? I was pleased to see a list of those things, but DOD is feeling the same environmental pressures as private utilities and so forth. How committed is the military to using coal or using it for God help us, an expanded use?
I'll be more comfortable with you.
Well, that's certainly something that we're always keeping an eye on as well, is what the military's plans are for their electric or for their energy mix. We deal with them on a daily basis, yearly contracts. But yeah, you're right. They are facing challenges as well. One of the issues that we have been working with our congressional delegation on is allowing the military to, I can't think of the exact act right now, but allowing the permit to be able to use other fossil fuels that are less expensive. For instance, the coal to liquids or even coal gasification projects, being able to, I want to say the restriction is on, sorry, this is not on the tip of my tongue, but the restriction is on if they can use an alternative fuel source that is less, that's exactly right, that doesn't cost more than 5% of what they're already using. And so that's, I know Congress is looking at repealing that or making changes to that now, so I'll get more versed on that and get back
to
you.
Well, and one other item to keep in mind, the base is there, a big reason that coal really works well for them is because it's not just for electric generation. They mm-hmm. heat their entire base. So if they were to switch out, they would have to do unit heaters and all the other bases, which up in that area, it's all diesel-fired, and then get electricity, draw electricity off the grid, and the cost of that, they're much better off just being self-contained and doing all that. And the cogeneration aspect really helps with the economics of it as well.
And that is one of the strengths of the military in Alaska, is that we do have indigenous supplies of relatively low-cost fuel, so that's another reason.
And I have two questions. Although I actually went to Wisconsin and saw some of the new mines, new coal plants. But what they did is they end up going through 4 or 5 years of litigation. Mm-hmm. And they have the population to be able to do that. I mean, it still costs them a lot. I can't imagine, like, for Fairbanks, if we had to go through that same litigation, there would be just, in my opinion, no way of being able to then make it pencil out, although I don't know what else we would utilize. But my big question is, of course, we have an air quality problem, and I think coal actually is one of our ways out, especially with the ones that are automatic feed, right. Keeps it up to a certain heat. One of the issues that we're struggling with, though, is that EPA does not certify, in fact, they just exempt coal altogether when it comes to residential heating devices. Is that somewhere where you could help us figure out, you know, how we could take the numbers of those types of units tested to come up with some kind of equivalent for those being used with wood or pellets? Because we need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It may not be Lorelei or I, but we can get the resources to help out to look where that has been done elsewhere and use our network of knowledge to see what we can do to help.
Absolutely. I appreciate that, because there's no reason for the EPA to do it, because we are probably one of the few communities in which it would pencil out to be able to do that. And years away, no matter if we're talking about a trucking project or a gas line, mm-hmm. you know, when we're talking short term, literally, people are putting these in no matter what, and they're putting a lot more of the shovel ones in, and the automated ones are the way to go. But without having that certification, it's hard to be able to show people why these are so much better and so much cleaner. So appreciate the help.
Jeff. So Jeff Jesse from Mental Health Trust. Over the next 30 years, royalties from trust coal could nearly double the trust's $360 million endowment. And the trustees are resolute in wanting to fulfill their mission to develop those resources. But they are inundated with organized opposition. People come to our trustee meetings and stand up with banners. They bring their small children to meetings and explain in front of them how our mining efforts will poison their children. Is there a role for the Coal Association or the legislature in helping us to push back against these organized, outside-funded activities?
One of the reasons we're standing here today, Jeff, is because to date, the only time you usually heard coal brought up was in some kind of negative context. Our industry has we're a pretty small industry. We got large potential, and we're proud of the opportunities we have, but it's been Use Valley and a few other companies just doing their thing. But you saw that increase in spending to go from $80,000 to $800,000 to $1.5 million a year just from that one foundation. That's why you hear more and more of these battle cries against coal. And that's when, at our last Coal Association meeting, we decided it's time for us to start telling a little bit more about our industry. And then if we want to get on to factual issues about coal use or the other things, we as an industry could come to the board meeting, or we're developing talking points that are factual based to say, here's what, we hear what some of the issues are, and here's what we know about those.
I think the biggest challenge is that the extreme environmentalists use fear and hysteria to help them raise money to perpetuate their own existence. And, we have to tell you the truth. Dan and I can't stand up here and lie to you. We can't sugarcoat it. We can't tell you what you want to hear if it's not the absolute truth. We are held to very high standards by law and regulation. Coal mining in Alaska is heavily regulated, very comprehensive laws and regs in place. But you have to think about it. The opposition is not held to that same standard. They can come in here and tell you whatever they want, and they're never held accountable for it. Think about it this way. all of the consumers in this state who have who receive mental health benefits from the state of Alaska, they're not coming into the Sierra Club meetings or the Trustees for Alaska meetings and saying, look at my child who needs greater access to mental health programs in the state, and you guys are opposing projects, because they don't do that, right? People who support a project stay home. People who oppose a project show up. It's a challenge, but you know, as Dan and I said, this is why we're blowing the dust off the Alaska Coal Association, revamping, revitalizing, getting more partners with the other companies, just to kind of stay at our case, because we have nothing to be ashamed of and we have nothing to hide. We have an excellent story to tell in this state on mining as well as generation. And
what could the legislature do to help, you think?
Ooh. Well,
you know, what?
What's holding back the people who are in the industry to give money to just like the environmentalists do?
Money. It takes a lot of money just to run a company.
I mean, they spend $1 million. I mean, you know.
I tell you what, I mean, our company doesn't have pockets like that to be able to fund $1 million PR campaign. That's why we're joining together, so we can pool the resources of our different companies to make a larger impact. But you know, private fundraising in the environmentalist movement is unbelievable, right? I mean, you have, well,
Well, and then to tie that in, to speak to Jeff's question, one of the big things, if you a lot of these funds that come in end up in the courts, and projects get tied up in the courts. The Wishbone Hill project was poised for development until lawsuits were filed and that development stopped again. You know, it happened in the 90s. We aren't even through a permitting phase and we've already had litigation. So one of the bills in front of legislature this year is to look at, is there a way to bring some sensibility back to that litigation? So
Representative Feige has an excellent bill that he'd like to that he would like to talk about that could certainly help us out here.
Actually, no, I had a question, but just would like to recognize Representative Hughes is with us in the back. You know, the Riversdale project is literally just up the hill from where I live, mm-hmm. and they're engaged in a fully permitted project, you know, exploring to see what's there. A lot of people have, you know, they have, you know, people in my community certainly have opinions one way or the other, and to say that the truth has been skewed is probably an understatement. One thing I've noticed is that there seem to be, you know, used to be if you were against a project, you wrote letters to the editor, you spoke up, you testified either in front of the legislature and as part of the permitting process. But what I'm sensing, what I'm starting to see, is a lot more active efforts to actually go out and directly hinder some of your operations. Have you guys had any experience with that, as far as, you know, individuals sort of taking the law into their own hands?
Civil disobedience type of stuff?
I'll just messing with you, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we experienced it during the exploration program 2 summers ago at Wishbone Hill. An example is we had 2.7 miles of our exploration trail staked. It had been surveyed, and some people went in there and removed the stake, so that certainly causes us money and time again. But, you know, again, I have met with the various groups in the MATSU. There's pretty much like a handful of groups, but it's all the same people that just have different positions on the boards within these same groups. And I've met with them, and we always have an open door. Again, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We have nothing to hide. We're always happy to talk about our project. But they still continue to say things that they know aren't true. You know, we had a presentation by one of their groups at the Palmer Chamber of Commerce. I got to follow up the next week, and I titled my presentation Scary Baloney, because that is pretty much everything that the organization presented. And so, you know, again,
whether they, their motives are entirely different from ours. In the back.
How do Alaska's mining taxes compare to other jurisdictions?
Do you have, off the top of your head how? I mean, it's they're competitive. I mean, it is a, we have several, like for our project in itself, we'll pay a royalty to the landowner for the coal removed. We'll pay property taxes to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Lorelei would pay property taxes to the Mat-Su Borough for their project, or as would the others. Mm-hmm. Mining license taxes get paid. That's for any company on any lands, and that goes to the state based on their revenues off the production. Then you get into the corporate taxes. So they're all, it's all very competitive compared to what the other states have.
Yes, sir.
Bill Leedy, a Juneau resident. Coal is only useful to us in Alaska or anywhere else in the world unless we, if we make iron and iron ore from it, or if we burn it to make heat and carbon dioxide and water vapor and a bunch of other miscellaneous pollutants. So because accelerated CO2 emissions are exacerbating the climate change problem and ocean acidification, shouldn't the state of Alaska's policy be to keep the coal in the ground, to minimize letting any of it escape because it's going to be oxidized and turned into carbon dioxide, shooting ourselves in the foot?
Well, our state constitution is based on responsible resource development. Section 8 of our constitution specifically says that our resources will be made available for the best use to benefit the public. And again, the balance between proper regulation and development is essential. So as new technologies come online that, that provide a better way of mining as well as generating, those are things that we as a society have to look at and incorporate. But I think the important issue is striking the right balance. Well, I guess I would disagree with your statement in its entirety, and so that would be a completely different conversation to have. Yeah.
Well,
yes, sir.
I believe coal-fired plants, their primary purpose is to produce electricity, run big turbines that produce electricity. They do it all over the United States for the cheapest rates that we know of in this country. My question is, I believe there was a little knock on the utilities, but I believe MEA tried really hard and that they just couldn't either get the social license to do it, or perhaps it was regulatory. I think Jeff Jesse asked earlier, is it state or federal? Is it primarily a federal regulatory issue? Is there something the state can do? Or is it strictly a social license issue where it's all about selling your message?
Well, in my opinion, the social license has to be tempered by proper regulation. Again, if there are comprehensive laws in place that protect, I mean, think about it this way. The entire coal program, the laws and regulations for the coal program, the whole point is to do two things: protect public health and protect the environment, right? And so the social license has to be balanced with proper regulation. You talked about the MEA situation. Their local government is looking at redoing the ordinance that regulates power plants in the borough. That's a good step for them if they do want to have additional generators come online in the borough. But it is definitely a big federal issue as well. Yes.
And to speak a little more specific, that the air standards and air quality is set by EPA. The state of Alaska runs the air program, so they take EPA's regulations and implement them through their air permitting program, which the EPA has oversight on. And for the MEA one, I kind of believe that in right now with their breaking ground and not knowing what their fuel source is, they probably really wish they would have gone forward with their coal-fired power plant, I think. And a lot of that one was a local ordinance that really knocked that one out. The Mat-Su Borough rushed through and passed a set of ordinances that just scared MEA away, and they said, forget it, we're going to drop that idea.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
We appreciate your time.
I want to thank Lorelei Sonnen.
Thank you. Thank you.
thank you all for being here. Thanks to representatives here, and thanks for enjoying Lunch and Learn, Dine and Dash. See you back here next Tuesday.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Shotgun test from Belt's room. Shotgun test from Belt's room. Shotgun test from Belt's room. Control. Oh, I will.